Hey there. If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening to another episode of Crime Off the Grid. I'm Tara, and I've got my awesome and frequent co-host with me again today. My friend Abby is kind enough to squeeze in some podcast time with me. Hi, Abby.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
Are you freezing? Because everywhere in the country is cold and snowy.
I feel like it's been a non-winter where we are. But maybe I have a weird standard.
No, I bet you do. I bet you do, because it's been cold and snowy everywhere. And that's about right, because knowing you, you're saying cold, snow, no problem. This isn't even winter. Hold my beer.
I have a rule. You have to live in a place where there's either no winter and you can be outside
right
12 months of the year, or you have to live in a place where it commits to winter and yeah, you can ski all winter.
And it's not committing this year is what you're saying.
No, it's not committing. So that's my problem.
Well, just, I can't,
you know, one or the other, but nothing in between.
Right. I cannot seem to get warm this winter for some reason. And I was just kind of curious because it makes me think of the coldest temperature I've ever been in. So what is the coldest temperature? Because you have a job where you work off the grid in wild places. Like, what's the coldest temperature you've ever been in?
You know, I think somewhere around negative 45.
Yeah, same Z's.
Yeah,
I spent
all day outside in the negative 35.
Yeah, yeah. I went to one snowmobile crash in Yellowstone in 40 something below zero, crash with injuries. And of course, I was mad, not at the poor people, but just in general, letting people snowmobile inside of Yellowstone. Not closing the park. This is way back in the day, I guess, but that was very, very difficult. Hard to start an IV on a trauma in 40 below while you're waiting on. Anyway, very, very cold. And then one of the dumbest.
When they're not warm, you can't get a vein.
No, you cannot. And then I think on one ski backcountry multi-day ski trip, we started in minus 16. We left the trailhead on our skis in minus 16. And at the time I'm like, this is stupid. But we watched the weather carefully, and within a couple of hours, it was supposed to be, you know, in the teens or close, you know, maybe 10. And it did, but looking back, maybe that wasn't the smartest thing to do.
It's all fine until something goes wrong.
And exactly.
And then negative 16 doesn't help.
No, it doesn't. Well, we're going to go to tropical paradise for today's case. So I'm perfect. Trying to, think on that a little bit. But even with
warm thoughts,
but even with that being said, the case that we're going to talk about actually sends cold chills down my spine. And I visited this park last month. And since then, I've had this incident on my mind, and I felt like I had to do a podcast about it so I could get it out of my head. And it just was so visual for me since I was just there. And so I really wanted to tell the story.
Well, we always choose happy topics, but I think this one is worth talking about.
Right. This one is very worth talking about. And it takes place in Kaloko Hona Kohau National Historic Park on the island of Hawaii, which is also referred to as the Big Island. And the park is 1,160 acres in size, including 596 acres of marine area. So it's not a big park at all. And the landscape consists of rocky shoreline, sandy beaches, coral rubble, and mangrove wetland areas. See, this is making me feel warmer already. And at one time, this was a thriving ancient Hawaiian settlement. It's like full of interest and culture. And the park was established in 1978 to preserve and protect the traditional native Hawaiian culture and historical sites. The cultural resources within the park include engineered fish ponds, petroglyphs, and some religious sites. And these fish ponds, awesome. It is like the fish ponds are so cool. We went to another park nearby that also had this historic fish ponds were created by like building this rock seawall out of lava rock. The whole area is a big lava landscape until you get to the shoreline. But this lava rock seawall that separates the bay from the sea with these gates that controlled the flow of the water between the water bodies. And studies suggested that ancient Hawaiians used the fish ponds for over 600 years. And the fish ponds served as an important wetland for migratory birds, hosting a wide variety of species. And so it's such a cool, interesting place. And I'll put up some pics of the park, or you can just look it up online.
But it sounds like a pretty amazing place.
When we were on our trip, we would pass the entrance to the park on our way to some other areas that we were going, and we definitely planned our trip to make sure we could go there. And why I really wanted to visit this park, the news that all national park rangers received on December 12th, 1999. And when we were finally there, the very first thing I saw at the start of the trail that we were going to be walking on was a memorial to Ranger Steve Makuakane Jarrell. And before we get started with the details of this case, this is a kind of story that I hesitate to discuss, kind of mentioning it before, and mainly because for me, and probably you too, Abby, it requires a lot of emotional energy and I have to mentally prepare for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for a lot of you, it might be also hard to hear. So there's your warning. Well, a visitor walking the beach in the late morning of December 12th, 1999, saw what looked like drag marks across the sand. So she followed them. And I can imagine she might have thought maybe they were from a sea turtle or a seal. We saw a monk seal when we were there. But she follows them and finds the body of a park ranger in a brushy, heavily vegetated area. And of course, she calls 911. His weapon was also missing from its holster. It turns out the ranger was last seen or heard from at 10 a.m., which was about 90 minutes before this visitor made this discovery. National Park Service law enforcement ranger Steve Makuakane Jarrell was responding to a visitor complaint about three unleashed and vicious dogs. There's a trail that's about 1 mile long from the visitor parking area to the shoreline, and it goes over, like I said, lava rock and past those historic fish ponds. And it actually feels very desert-ish, really dry. And I don't know where Ranger Steve was at the time of the call, but regardless, it wouldn't have been a long walk to get there. What the investigation indicated was that Ranger Steve had deployed his pepper spray on the dogs, and they found the partially expended canister on the ground. And I have to say, it sounds benign, but going to a call about a dog off leash can be a call that can go south pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's certain, I guess what you think of as low-level calls that always have the potential to escalate, and dog-related calls are one of those call types.
They really do. And he likely knew that since the report was about vicious dogs, that he might need to use his pepper spray or even shoot a dog possibly. And in my experience, someone that has no regard for others in the area, in a public area, especially with letting their vicious dogs run around terrorizing people or running loose, probably has no regard for authority. And they can be like some of the hardest people to deal with. You know, I know my rights. You can't tell me what to do when they have their dog somewhere that they're not supposed to, especially like in backcountry settings.
Yeah, I have found that, anytime you're addressing, you know, a dog owner who's not a responsible dog owner, that person has just a higher likelihood of being challenging to work with.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a lot of great dog owners out there.
Yeah. Oh no, of course. Of course. I'm not anti-dog. I love dogs. Yeah.
We know that.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Well, there was a struggle with the dog owner, and somehow he got control over Ranger Steve's weapon. And I'm sure it happened very quickly. Law enforcement officers spend time training in weapon retention techniques, you know, how to keep anyone from getting your weapon. Because if someone is attempting to get your weapon, they are going to use it on you, period. And that's one reason why you should never come up to any officer and touch their weapon. You know, like, kids really want to do that when you're in public. And
Oh my goodness.
So teach your kids, don't stay clear from that, and don't even act like you're going to touch it. Because it, you know, it becomes muscle memory to have certain reactions. You know, if a hand moves towards your gun, and you might quickly get an elbow in your face.
You know, another thing with this is when you see that pepper spray was used, that's a close range defensive weapon. And you're not going to use that kind of weapon unless, you know, whether it's the dogs or the person have come into close range to you.
Right. So, yeah, no, exactly.
Like I said before, that suggests a pretty close range, fast incident that it probably went downhill really fast.
Yeah. And I don't know if, I don't think I saw this anywhere, and I don't know how they would know unless the suspect mentioned this later in an interview, but I don't know if he already had his weapon out because maybe he was using pepper spray on dogs, and maybe he had his weapon out for that. I have no idea. Or if the suspect got it out of his holster. So that's an unknown detail.
Yeah.
Anyway, that can happen so fast. And I'm sure in his case, he's concentrating on not getting attacked by the dogs, and the dog owner's probably screaming at him, "Leave my dogs alone." And in the struggle, his weapon, you know, came out, and the suspect got it and shot him 2 times with his own gun, once in the arm and torso and once in the forehead. And think how this encounter probably only lasted seconds. Ranger Steve was just on patrol doing his job, responding to something he's probably had to take care of so many times before, and in seconds, he loses his life. The suspect then dragged Ranger Steve's body into the brush, then hit his gun nearby with just putting a rock on top of it, as they later discovered. So the FBI put out a description of a suspect wanted for the murder of Ranger Steve. They were looking for a 6-foot-tall man, about 30 years old, with 3 dogs, which they'd gotten this information and description of the possible suspect from their investigation. According to the Honolulu Star Bulletin, a local resident named Samson Wana Jr. was returning home from work Tuesday afternoon, 2 days after the murder, when he saw a man walking out of the shrub brush along a highway in Kona who was trying to flag him down. And that would have been just a few miles from the park. And as Wana, who was a truck driver, as he's driving past, he noticed 3 dogs following the man. And he said that he thought to himself, "Oh, Lord," I'm quoting here, "Oh, Lord, that's the guy, the one that shot the ranger," end quote. Well, Wana was 34 years old, 6'3" and 275 pounds. And he was a big boy. And he backed up his truck thinking he's going to do something because he knows he's wanted. And, you know,
big boy.
He's a big boy. And I'm thinking, well, that's probably why he backed up and stopped. Cause I think, you know, if I had that thought to myself, I'd be like, "Oh, I'm driving up here and I'm calling the cops. I'm not going to back up and stop." And so he probably felt a little confident in doing that. So he tried to call for help on his CB radio, but got no answer. And I don't know, it didn't describe the truck. So I don't know if it was a semi or if he was just someone who had, you know, who liked talking on his CB radio, which maybe they still did in the '90s. I don't know.
They still do that now.
Oh,
truck drivers? Yeah.
Well, no, big. I know semi truck drivers do, but anyway,
or if you're in Idaho, you know,
probably in Idaho, maybe Montana, or you know, the ham radio people. That's the kind of people. Those are people like, you know, the people that have machetes. You know, that's a type. The ham radio people. There's a type. Like you could probably, that could be our new game. Like I bet he's got a ham radio. You know.
You do have some good games.
Hey, by the way, but when I was a kid, that was a big thing. We got a CB radio, and my brother would sit out in the driveway in this white old Chevy. I don't know what kind of car that was. And talk on the CB radio, and everybody had handles. And that was a big, that was like our, I guess, the version of texting or Snapchat. You know, it was probably a version of, I don't even know what's new out there. But anyway, okay, while we went
down. What would your handle be then?
I am not going to tell you what my handle was then. It was so stupid.
I need to know now.
I'll tell you later. Okay. I'm not going to tell you. It was so stupid. But I do remember.
If you have it, I'm going to totally post it.
Yeah, no, no. I think my mother told me, you should use this name. And it was, of course, that's why it was stupid, because moms don't come up with cool things. anyway, wow, that's a squirrel trail. We just went
off. Oh, yeah, we squirreled. Okay.
Okay, so this would-be hitchhiker walks up to the camper covered back of the truck as if to put his dogs inside. And Juana says, like, he was getting really nervous. So he got out of his car, his truck, and flags down another car and whispers to the driver that the hitchhiker, hey, this is the man that shot the ranger. And the driver turned out to be from the sheriff's office there, which that was cool. The hitchhiker started to loosen the grip off the leash of one of his dogs. And I don't know what that meant, if it was as if to sick his dogs on him, or if it was still him trying to put his dogs up. But Juana said that he tells the hitchhiker, hey, I've got a 6-inch hunting knife. And quote, it's going to be your dogs if you get crazy, bruh. Sorry. That's what's quoted in this article. End quote. Anyway.
It sounds really threatening when you say it, so.
Right. I've never used it. Anyway, I didn't know that was a term back then. Brah. Hey, bruh. Or bruh. I don't know, but that's how it's spelled. B-R-A-H. Well, Juana ordered the guy to stand next to the truck. And then the suspect answered, you're crazy. You're nuts. So the suspect started to walk away from an embankment, but he went tumbling down the slope. And with the bushes and grass only waist high, there was no place for him to hide. I mean, also, you can't hide three dogs. You know, they're going to be like trying to get up. You're not going to hide three dogs. And it's tall grass, whatever. So he continues walking, like, I guess, towards the shoreline, or just walking. I'm not exactly where sure, but he's walking on that old, really rough lava. It's all just big lava beds between the highway and the shoreline. And Juana says, I was like, this guy ain't too bright. And so according to him, a bit later, the whole thing took maybe like 15 or 20 minutes. A helicopter shows up and then began circling above the suspect. Then Juana recalls like a series of FBI police cars. The cavalry is coming, and officers went into the lava field after the suspect, who was now just out of sight, kind of beyond, you know, sort of roly-poly lava beds. And so just out of sight beyond a little ridge thing. And Juana hears a voice on the radio calling for animal control, and then he hears that the suspect was detained. So this guy was very responsible. Had a lot to do with this guy's capture. So Eugene Frederick Boyce III was arrested. He was a 30-year-old California native and described as an unemployed transient. Okay, as I'm reading this, it sounds like a contestant on the dating game. I'm sorry. Bachelor number one is a 30-year-old California native and an unemployed transient. I'm sorry. This is what I thought of. I don't know why.
Where your brain goes.
That's where our brain goes. And because did you know a serial killer was a contestant on the dating game and won? Look up.
That's both terrifying and not all that shocking.
And probably weird that I know this, but I did have to look up the name because I couldn't remember the name. But it's Rodney Alcala, A-L-C-A-L-A. A-L-C-A-L-A, and he won. But you can even see this on YouTube, you know. But somehow the poor girl who picked him, they found out some information about him the day after. And I don't know that they found out he was a serial killer, but they found out something. And she was able to get out of her date with him. Anyway, that's another squirrel. Yeah. So, I mean, that's weird that I had that in my head. And that's why I thought this sounded like a Bachelor number one. Anyway. Well,
continue.
Yeah. Well, Boyce was arraigned in federal court in Honolulu on charges of assaulting and murdering a United States park ranger, 18 U.S.C. 1111 and 1114, and was held without bail. The arrest was the result of like this huge multi-agency effort among National Park Service investigators, FBI agents, Hawaii County Police, and Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources officers. So everybody, like I said, the cavalry was out and investigating and searching for this guy. Boyce admitted to shooting Ranger Steve while he laid on the ground, and he said he turned the ranger's 9mm semi-automatic pistol against him during the struggle, quote, which resulted in the ranger shooting himself. So he was describing the struggle and that it was just accidental that during this struggle, the ranger shoots himself. And this was in the affidavit. But then he said he shot Ranger Steve in self-defense. But Myron Fuller, who's the FBI special agent in charge, said evidence so far does not support Boyce's claim of self-defense. And also, that's not really a thing, or it shouldn't be a thing, claiming self-defense when an officer's attempting to get you to comply or gain custody and control over you.
Yeah. And if you've got the vicious dogs, it's even harder. Even if it wasn't a police officer showing up, I don't know how you'd even make that claim.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't say I refused to comply and I got all bowed up and the officer tried to handcuff me. Therefore, I had to shoot him in self-defense.
Oh.
But then Boyce says to agents, quote, if I could have, I would have emptied the gun. I shot him as many times as I could, end quote. And I don't know. You know, he had control of the gun and he shot him twice. So I don't know what this boasting was about, you know, when he told the agents this. So this happened in 1999. And then as of 2006, there still had not been a trial. Initially, the federal government was seeking the death penalty. The state of Hawaii did not and does not have the death penalty, but Boyce was facing federal charges. They later dropped seeking the death penalty due to mental competency.
So was he ever found competent to stand trial?
Well, yes. And I'm really glad we had a couple episodes back, Dr. Wright, the forensic psychologist, on one of our episodes, because he talked about competency with the criminal defendants and how it can be raised at any time by anyone, mm-hmm. such as the defense, prosecution, the court, you know, so on and so on. And in this case, that seemed to be happening here throughout the process over years. He would be deemed incompetent, ordered to undergo psychiatric treatment, then deemed competent, then incompetent again, you know, just wash, rinse, repeat. But I was looking in the court documents and everything is sealed. You can hardly get any information from there because so much is sealed. And it's because of all of the mental health issues that they keep having motions about and competency hearings, et cetera. And so in 2002, I believe, he finally rendered his plea. Like he hadn't even had a plea yet. So he pled not guilty. At his trial in 2006, a Federal Bureau of Prisons psychologist testified for the defense that Boyce suffered from paranoia and schizophrenia and could not appreciate the wrongfulness of his acts due to his psychotic state. The psychologist testified Boyce believed the ranger was trying to kill him and his dogs. So in Boyce's mind, according to this psychologist, he feared for his life because this ranger comes out of nowhere and is intent on killing Boyce and killing his dogs. And so in his mind, that's why there was this self-defense thing that he said. And it was a problem trying to overcome the government's own psychologist during his trial, which was a bench trial and not a jury trial for some reason. The U.S. District Judge Susan Okey Mulway found the 37-year-old Boyce not guilty by reason of insanity following a five-hour trial.
Five-hour trial?
Yep, bench trial. Just a judge, no jury. And I'm guessing
but
that
only
was
5 hours?
Yep, that was that was the defense's request. They got to choose if they wanted to go before a judge or a jury. But the 5-hour trial was interesting. And I have a feeling that all she felt like she needed to hear was, this guy suffers a serious mental defect and disease. And that was probably all she needed to hear to render him not guilty by reason of insanity. And that verdict applied on all three charges. He actually had a charge of being a felon in possession of a firearm, which I could not find his criminal history and where he was a convicted felon in the past, probably in California. And I looked there and I couldn't find that. But all three charges of murder on a federal government employee engaged in official duties, using a firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence, and being a felon in possession of a firearm were all not guilty by reason of insanity.
Hmm. And, you know, I mean, somebody who's like homeless, I mean, that the link between homelessness and mental health is very strong. But
yeah,
murdering another person, that makes the person very, very dangerous, regardless of the mental health history. And obviously they were dangerous to visitors, too. Yeah, it's just the whole thing is
right. Well, I feel like I need to get Dr. Wright back on here, because what I don't understand are states that say not guilty by reason of insanity. What does that mean at that point? And what I believe it, what I understand it to mean is they will be held until which time they are deemed not a threat to society or a risk to society anymore. So,
yeah,
you know, I think that's scary, because while they're being treated in a mental facility, mental health facility, they're medicated. And we know that it's very, very difficult for people who are suffering from mental disease and mental illness will go off their meds and stop taking their meds. And then what happens?
Yeah. Yeah, somebody who's maybe not a threat, according to a psychiatrist, when they're in a controlled environment and getting treatment and medication, isn't necessarily going to forever not be a threat just because they are in that snapshot of a moment.
Exactly.
You know, if they're released and then they don't have that environment anymore to keep them stabilized, then what's to say they don't, you know, go spiraling down into where they were before?
Right. Well, Ranger Steve's wife said, and she's actually the legal victim under the law in this case, and she's allowed to make victim impact statements in court at the sentencing, which in this case there was no sentencing, but she was still able to get her voice heard. She said, quote, "The not guilty by reason of insanity means the burden of proof is on Boyce, yet we have to be there every time there's a hearing of any kind to be sure he won't get out, so it's still a burden." And she says, "You don't go on with your life, not with a verdict like that." It's been a tough...
We talk about re-victimization. That's a prime example.
Oh, exactly. She said, it's been tough these past 7 years on the family. No matter how long it's been, it's not any easier. We think of him every day. We think of all the things he's missed, she said of herself and her children, who were then at the trial 22, 23, and 30 years old. He never got to see the children graduate from high school. He never got to see their son get married.
And it sounds like this was he was a family guy who was dedicated to his work. He was committed to his community. It sounds like a pretty upstanding, committed person, you know?
Absolutely. He was incredibly well-liked and well thought of. And I'll read what the Park Service said about him in just a moment. But prosecution said that they would ask for Boyce's continued detention at a custody hearing that came November 20th of that year, and would continue, quote, "fighting for detention as long as he comes up for review," end quote. So that's good. Like, that's something that, you know, every single year he would have to do. Boyce was held at the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. And he was remanded to the Bureau of Prisons for a mental health study to see whether he poses a risk of danger to people or property, the U.S. Attorney's Office said in a written statement. And according to the public access to court electronic records, he had an annual risk assessment, and all those were sealed. Like I said, I could not find that in his public records until his death. So it appears that he died in 2017. And I was able to see where there was a written memo saying, yes, we provided you with a death certificate. So it looks like he died in 2017.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I was reading about this is that one of the changes that came to this area in Hawaii was that they established a Pacific Area Communication Center, which is basically a dispatch that's located within Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. And it's just incredible to me to have to, you know, he's going out working by himself at a time where there was still limited cell phone use.
Right.
And he didn't have a dispatch doing checks on him. And to have 90 minutes go by when you're on a call and nobody's following up with you, you know, 90 minutes is way too long to be out on a dog call.
Exactly.
That's a huge safety hazard to have to deal with. And I'm glad that that's been addressed.
Wow. That's a very good point, because normally, and when a law enforcement goes on a contact, they're communicating with their dispatch. I'll be out doing this, whatever contact I'm on, running checks, and then the dispatch is checking on you for your welfare. They're doing the welfare checks. You're right. And then that was clearly not done here. And who knows if that would have saved his life or not? Had there been a 6-minute, 9-minute welfare check? Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't know. Or if he had access to, you know, even being able to ask for a second.
Right.
You know, I feel like having two people going into a call, if you can recognize early on that there's an increased risk, makes it, and it's all what ifs, you know, we don't know.
Yes.
And that's not really the question, but
being
able to incorporate that so that people can be safer now is pretty huge.
Yeah. Well, this is what the Park Service said about Ranger Steve. Makuakane Jarrell leaves his wife, his 3 children, and his 2 brothers. He served as a ranger for 15 years. 7 of those were at Kaloko Honokohau, where he shared his passion for communicating the importance of preserving the coastal park's biological resources and perpetuating its unique cultural heritage. He also worked as a ranger at the USS Arizona Memorial in Oahu and at Andersonville and Jimmy Carter National Historic Sites in Georgia. Prior to his employment by the National Park Service, Makuakane Jarrell, a native of Athens, Georgia, worked for the Georgia State Park System. He and his wife met while attending a ranger training class at Grand Canyon National Park in 1986. Their long-distance relationship, he was in Georgia and she was in Hawaii, became a permanent union when he moved to Hawaii. They soon married and he embraced the Hawaiian way, taking on her name along with his own. He was dedicated to the resource and to visitor protection, laboring to safeguard oral histories, archaeological sites, geological formations, and rare and endangered plants, birds, and sea animals. His enthusiasm about the National Park Service mission was contagious, and he readily shared it with friends, family, visitors, and school children. So, he sounded like he was where he wanted to be, loved where he worked, and his wife worked for the National Park Service as well. So, that was difficult to talk about because it was so, I'm using air quotes here when I say routine of a call, which goes to show in law enforcement, there are no routine calls.
Yes. Yep.
And there have been studies that show that National Park Rangers have a higher rate of being assaulted than other federal officers, including FBI.
Wow.
Did you know that?
Is that, and I did the study give any reasons why they thought that was a thing? Did they stick to just the statistics?
The study that I read in detail actually is a very old study. So that was back in 2002 by Peer, P-E-E-R. And a lot of it has to do with rangers being in remote settings alone, responding as a single unit, which, you know, that nothing's changed. And, you know, like other federal agencies like the FBI, they're going together. They know where they're going. They know that they're going to contact a bad guy, bring them into custody, perhaps. You know, I'm just in some situations I'm saying here. But we're a ranger who also we're told to be friendly and do the lowest level of law enforcement sometimes. And a lot of times we're going for the purpose of helping someone, you know, with EMS or somebody who's got a disabled vehicle or giving somebody just information about the park where they work. And so your guard is sort of, you're sort of off guard a little bit, but we're trying to train so that we're not. And so, yeah. So those are some of the reasons.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of U.S. park rangers have been assaulted while they were wearing a different hat of being a EMS provider in the back of an ambulance. And you might be familiar with some people who have been assaulted in the back of an ambulance from a patient.
Yeah, it's a thing that happens. Just because somebody's a patient or a victim or a stranded motorist, you don't know, you know, what that person's history is necessarily. You don't know what they've got going on or what they're worried you're going to find out.
Right.
And so you really, you know, you go into every situation not really having that full story.
Exactly. Well, I don't know about you, Abby, but I need to change course and talk about something that may take a little less emotional energy. So I looked up dumb criminals in the National Park Service, and I came up with a few things that I thought would be fun to just end this with. And I bet you've heard of these cases too. The headline here is a woman graffitied her Instagram handle all over several national parks. An Instagram artist named Casey Knockett was banned from all national parks for life. That's pretty extreme.
Life.
Yeah. Wow. After graffiti of her Instagram handle was documented in 7 different parks in 2014. I remember this. I remember when this was on the news. She posted the images of her tags of her own Instagram. So so it was pretty easy.
Wait, so
to
she catch posted her.
Her
own Instagram and then posted pictures of her own Instagram on her Instagram?
I think I'm going to have to put some of these pictures up there. So she's an artist, and I'm looking at one picture here, and then she puts her handle.
Artist is a strong term.
Well, she's pretty good. Yes.
Okay. I'll have to look around.
Yeah. And so, and I'm not talking about on a wall, writing on a wall or writing on a rock. I'm looking at a picture here that covers maybe it looks like it's probably at least a half acre in size. And
oh
it's,
my gosh.
Yeah. It's I wonder if it's a self portrait, like a picture of a woman's head with giant blue hair and her name, which I kind of can't read that, in the year 2014, you know, the modern version of I was here, but that's extreme. Get her.
But
I don't know where
up.
She was.
We don't want more likes on her page.
She don't like her page. Don't follow her. Yeah. All right. And here's one I like. A woman smoked meth inside the hollow trunk of a 3,500-year-old tree. She started a fire and the entire tree burned down.
That's horrible.
No. Yeah.
Horrible.
A woman decided to light up in a massive 3,500-year-old cypress tree known as the Senator. I mean, the tree had a name. Oh, my goodness. And it caught fire and burned to the ground. The woman received 5 years of probation. Seriously? 5 years of just probation? Guess what state this was in? Do you have an idea?
I would have to say that's a Florida case.
Yes, Florida.
Okay. Between the cypress and the meth and the Florida woman.
Yeah. It's in a park called, not ironically, Big Tree Park. But I don't know if they had to change the name now. After the Senator burned down, they probably had to change the name of the park.
Oh, no. I hope they have another big tree.
I don't know. Or one that's old. I mean, that's so sad. But okay.
That tree survived.
I know. It couldn't survive a Florida woman lighting up meth. Yeah, hurricanes. Oh, my gosh. All right. This will be the last one. Some tourists thought bear spray, which pepper spray, worked like bug repellent and sprayed the hot chemicals all over their bodies. You know what? This is not a one-off. This is not unusual.
That is not a one-off.
No. Quote, I was in a national park at the visitor center. Suddenly, there's this huge commotion and a lot of screaming from the lobby. I head over to find an entire tourist family. Oh, the whole family crying and screaming, and the park staff trying their best to manage the situation. Then the air shifts and hits me. They had applied a liberal amount of, well, you know, a liberal amount of bear spray all over themselves in the entire lobby. Let me just say, when you squeeze that handle of bear spray, there's no way to get a little bit of bear spray going. It shoots out, blast. Like, what did we say in another case? Oh, the Yellowstone guy that was using bear spray as a weapon. I think it shoots out like 90 miles an hour or something when it comes out of the canister. So you don't, a liberal amount of bear spray is accurate because that's all you can do when you spray that canister. And apparently they had mistaken the word of bear repellent and had assumed it was meant to be used like mosquito repellent.
Yeah, they work a little. I mean, if you're covered in bear spray, you might repel bears. You also repel friends and family.
Right.
EMS providers.
Yes. Yes. And as I mentioned before, my youngest son tried that twice. So.
Third time's the charm.
Right. Maybe, well, yeah. He didn't. He was a child. He wasn't using it as a mosquito repellent. He was just like, what's this? Sprays himself. Then he does it again, you know, a few years later. Well, that's our episode for this week. And thank you again, Abby, for co-hosting. And stay safe in wild places and watch out for the company you keep.
And don't smoke meth in large trees.
Bye.
Bye. Okay.